On this week's program, we listen back to a recent conversation with Kimmel Center President and CEO Anne Ewers. Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of the costume designer in theatrical productions. We speak with Mari Yashahari, author of Musicians from a Different Shore. The book examines why musicians of Asian descent have come to enjoy unprecedented prominence in classical music. And Susan Lewis takes us to a story slam. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Prior to coming to Philadelphia, Anne Ewers was president and chief executive officer of Utah Symphony and Opera, the two performing arts organizations having merged in July 2002. During her tenure in Salt Lake City, Ewers doubled the organization's endowment from $18 to $36 million and turned a structural deficit of $1.8 million into a $360,000 surplus. Before Utah, she was general manager of the Boston Lyric Opera, and before that, an assistant stage director at San Francisco Opera. Anne Ewers took up the helm at the Kimmel Center during the summer, and when I spoke to her in early September, I asked how she had spent her first weeks in the corner office.
I've spent the last 2 months meeting with every single board member, one-on-one. 35. I have about 10 more to go. And in those conversations, people are very candid, very passionate, explaining and telling me some of their concerns, some of their issues, things that we need to improve on, things that they love. It's been absolutely revelatory. And that has been very exciting for me. Not that I didn't expect a good board, but when you see the expertise around this table and the potential of the Kimmel is amazing. I think what we have to realize is this is only 5 years old. And the first number of years were it was about construction and then startup. And now we're moving into a whole new phase. And the organization is really poised to take off. And I think there's so much that we can do, but it's important to recognize what's been done.
Your predecessor had both the advantage of having a new facility and all the novelty and all the interest that there is in something new, and I guess the disadvantage of having to deal with construction debt and water leaking through ceilings and all of the various teething problems that a new building such as this has. How do you now go about keeping the level of interest both in the donor community and in the audience at the level that it was at for those first 5 years?
Well, I think a couple of things. We are meant to be a destination location. That's one of the main missions of the Kimmel Center. And you can't become that overnight. So I think it's now our opportunity to reach out to a more broad, a more diverse audience. I think there is a real chance to do some things that you couldn't do in the first 5 years. I mean, look at Lincoln Center or Kennedy Center. Those things didn't happen overnight. And so we've got that chance now to keep that building and that growth and that excitement going forward. I mean, if you look at just the difference between the previous year and last year, 21% increase in audience. That's pretty good. And already we're seeing 1 million people come through that door. So it's now between ourselves, you know, the Kimmel Center itself and, of course, the Academy of Music. And so I think we can build on that. You're absolutely right. It's a challenge. It's a challenge to find new things that will entice people. I think there's a whole demographic that we're not serving as well as we might, the 20s, 30s, 40-year-olds. I think that artistically we can broaden from what we currently do. We do some amazing things, and the breadth is massive. But if you really are serving an entire community, you need to be able to have offerings that relate to every aspect of that community. I think also one of my primary goals right from the get-go is to get rid of the construction overage. Anybody who's involved in construction knows that an overage is expected. So a 12% overage is understandable. However, we now need to finish handling that $30 million shortfall from the construction, and I think that needs to be done swiftly, and that I think also will re-engage donors in their excitement. It will help people realize that we are on strong footing and moving forward. So I think that will do more than probably anything else to re-engage and involve donors. What's interesting, and I'll share my thinking on all of this, and it ties, frankly, to everything that we look forward to. I indicated that in the first 60 days of my tenure, I would make no main decisions, that I would use this as a time of listening and learning. And as I commented about meeting with every board member, I'm also meeting with clusters of 8 staff members until we get through the entire staff of 110. We just did it this morning. We have a CEO breakfast. And I ask each person to share their most creative idea that they've ever had about the Kimmel Center. It is amazing what people are coming forward with. What's important in all of this, as I listen to board, as I listen to staff, as I listen to members in the community, everyone has to embrace what it is we're about and what we're doing. For somebody to come in and dictate off the top has no long-term effect, because if people don't get excited, don't bring the ideas to the table, don't feel like they're empowered and a part of it, it means nothing. So what we talk about now are some great ideas, and our next step as a group is to decide, okay, which of these ideas do we want to bring forward? What is the time frame? Do we do this one now? Do we do this in 2 years? And so when I talk about education, it will need to be what we as a group, all of the ideas that we brought forward and how we'd like to splay that out. But certainly there's room for much growth, and I think everyone around the table is excited about that.
There have been over the years many occasions when people have commented about what the Kimmel is not doing in terms of making it accessible during the day and having people come in and use the building, not just when there are performances on. Are there other, well, first of all, is that something that you would like to see more of? And are there other things that you noticed the minute you got in the door and said, well, that's not right, or we're going to change that pretty quickly?
You know, of all my conversations, the hottest topic is exactly what you've just described. We're meant to be a destination location. Why aren't we having more daytime activity? Why is this place not booming? And you know what I love about the fact of our location? Kenny Gamble, one of our wonderful board members, his godmother used to run the Paradise Lounge on this site. The place was streaming with people. And, you know, Diana Ross would record across the street and come over for dinner and what have you. So the energy, as I like to say, on this location is perfect for that kind of excitement and that kind of presence and involvement. And I do think that we can get there. The ideas that people have come up with, all the way from what kind of activities can we have to how do we do something with signage, how do we do something with reorganizing what's going on in the lobby to make it more welcoming. The ideas are terrific, and the question is, okay, which do we do first, and how do we do this so we get the largest result for the action?
Kimmel Center President and CEO, Ann Ewers.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Whether we like to admit it or not, we tend to make assumptions about people based on their appearances. The creators of theater, opera, film, and television also believe that much is communicated by how a character dresses, and so costumes are given a great deal of consideration in productions. The person responsible for overseeing what actors wear is the costume designer. Now, as part of a continuing series about what it takes to bring theater to life, WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer provides a behind-the-scenes look at the costume designer's role.
Costume design has been around for quite some time. In ancient Greek theater, for instance, performers wore masks, tall shoes, and other garments that made them look larger than life. And throughout theater history, from Rome to Shakespeare to the present day, costumes have always been an integral part of the dramatic arts. For a long time, actors supplied their own outfits, sometimes simple, sometimes elaborate. But today, anything an actor wears on his or her body, from wigs to jewelry to underwear, was put there by a costume designer. It might sound easy enough to throw an outfit on a performer, but according to Marie-Anne Chiment, head of the costume design program at Temple University, that's not the case.
First of all, you have to be able to be a bit of a psychologist, because you want to understand who are these people that you're going to dress. You don't just place clothes on them. You actually try to get inside their heads and dress them as they would dress themselves. You also have to be an historian. You have to know all the periods of history for clothing. So if you are given a script that takes place in ancient Greece, you have to learn everything about those clothes so that you can dress people as if they were back in ancient Greece.
Chiment says that the role of a costume designer is surrounded by misconceptions. For starters, a costume designer is not a fashion designer or a stylist. Fashion designers design clothing to sell to the public, to be worn on the street. while stylists select clothing from fashion designers for, say, magazine layouts or red carpet events. The costume designer, on the other hand, may buy, rent, or have a costume made to strictly serve the world of a play, a film, or an opera. This world is created by the writer, and the writer's script, says Marla Jerglanis, is typically the starting point for the designer.
Most designers will pick it apart in as much detail as they possibly can, do as much background with the text.
Jerglanis, who's the resident costume designer at the People's Light and Theater in Malvern, Pennsylvania, believes that good text and character analysis are important parts of being a costume designer. One needs to be able to intimately understand the world and characters of a play before determining what clothing might be worn. In conjunction with poring over the script, Jerglanis says a designer also conducts a lot of research early on.
We all are crazy about, you know, finding any kind of, you know, photographs, paintings, you know, any crazy textures, colors, fabrics, anything we can find to pull together to start presenting our ideas to the director.
In general, a costume designer works closely with a director well in advance of any rehearsals. The length of time it typically takes to develop a production's costume design depends on budget, on how early a show is cast, and what kind of show it is. Temple professor Marie-Anne Chiment uses the metaphor of birth cycles to describe the different timelines.
If you're doing an opera, it's really closer to the birth cycle of a whale. It may take 2 years. If you're doing a play, it's probably closer to a horse. It might be 6 months. If you're doing television, it's more like a fly. You have about a day. So it's really dependent on what kind of personality you have as to whether you like to work really fast and stay up all night and do that kind of design, or if you like to have a long, spread out process.
Costume design can be extremely expensive. It sometimes involves tailoring a one-of-a-kind outfit. So careful planning is necessary. For most costume designers, a central part of the development process involves putting the ideas gleaned from script analysis and general research onto paper.
These were like my second set of drawings. I think I actually, like, usually I start with like rough sketches. So like the first.
Richard St. Clair, who's been designing costumes for nearly 30 years for groups like the Opera Company of Philadelphia and the Art and Theater, has stacks and stacks of such drawings. These sketches, often highlighted with watercolors, paint, or colored pencils, help to communicate the vision of a costume design for the others involved in the production. A costume designer, after all, isn't necessarily the one who sews together a new costume or alters an existing one. These tasks are usually delegated to others. Although a lot of detailed work can be put into sketches, Richard St. Clair says costume designers know nothing is permanent about the plans.
This is a roadmap. This isn't the costume on the stage. This is how you get to the costume on the stage, because the real art isn't this sketch. It's that person in a costume on the set, under the lights, all at the same time. So, like, this is just a means to an end. You can't get, like, real married to the fact that it has to look like this drawing, because at the end, it has to serve the show and it has to serve that performer on the stage.
For example, sometimes an actor's vision for a character might conflict with a designer's costume choice. While the final say ultimately lies with the director, Marla Jerglanis says she tries to be sensitive to an actor's initial reaction to a sketch or in a costume fitting.
I have to try to be aware when I notice that reaction to be able to develop along with them and not to force something on the performance that I have already decided.
A costume designer often develops a special bond with actors, according to Richard St. Clair, because a designer has to become very familiar with so many details of a performer's body.
The things I have to talk about to people, it gets kind of comical. I always say, you know, by the time an opera opens, I know everybody's breakups, I know everyone's operations, I know everyone's, you know, problems about their body and things they like and they don't like. It's like I become like the confessor to everybody. Like there they are in their underwear and they start telling me like everything I need to know and everything I don't need to know. So sometimes it does enter into like too much information.
But with information about the show in general, most costume designers prefer to err on the side of having too much of it. Ideally, they want to ensure that the outfits seem so natural to the world of the play that audience members don't even notice that anyone has designed the costumes.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Musicians from and of Asian descent are ubiquitous in the world of Western classical music. A significant presence in music schools, professional ensembles, and as concert soloists. How Eastern culture came to embrace Western music is the subject of a new book, Musicians from a Different Shore. Its author, Mari Yoshihari, is now an associate professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii, but began studying piano in her native Japan at the age of 3, a practice common among middle-class households in the last part of the 20th century. In her book, Yoshihari combines historical research with personal interviews of contemporary Asian and Asian American musicians to present both a comprehensive study of the intersection of culture, race, and music, and an intimate glance into the human stories behind the trends. It's obvious to anybody who goes to classical music concerts or who buys classical music recordings these days that there is a huge amount of Asian and Asian American musicians. Tell us the history of how we've got to this situation.
Well, this is, depending on how you see it, you can see it as a recent phenomenon or a more historical phenomenon. I would say that the noticeable increase in the number of Asians and Asian Americans in classical music, maybe about the last 2 or 3 decades, but there is a long history that led up to it, from the introduction of Western music to Japan, China, and Korea from the late 19th and early 20th century. And, those three nations made very programmatic efforts to make it a very central part of their culture, very much led by the government and then also pushed by the middle class, aspiration for middle class. So there's a long history leading up to it. And especially after the end of World War II in Japan and after Korean War in Korea, after the Cultural Revolution in China, it became a very widely middle class phenomenon for the people there to pursue classical music. So that's sort of the historical and social basis for this recent phenomenon.
And this was about looking west and saying what? What were people saying about the West that convinced them that classical music was something that children should learn?
I would say initially, in the early part of the 20th century, it was classical music was associated definitely with Western modernity. And so the aspiration to become bourgeois middle class was kind of the central economic and social pull for Asians. But one of the things that I'm trying to say in the book is that it became a lot more than that, especially in the last 2 or 3 decades. I would say that for most Asians in Asia today, classical music is not necessarily seen as something specifically European or even Western. It's a very central part of their own culture. And so they don't necessarily, especially the musicians who are pursuing it, they don't necessarily think of it as something, they're doing something foreign or Western. It's just, part of their lives and their identity.
You're not writing from a totally uninvolved point of view. Mm-hmm. You yourself went through this phenomenon, having your parents encourage you to take up
more
a musical
than
instrument.
Okay.
I was putting it as nicely as possible. What word should I use?
Push.
Okay. Your parents pushing you to take up a musical instrument.
Yeah.
The parental influence shouldn't be understated in this because amongst Asians, and I don't want to make a broad sweeping statement, but there would appear to be a greater respect and a greater desire to please one's parents in the East than there is in the West. Is that the case?
It's certainly a generalization, but I think, there's some truth to, those kinds of generalizations. And I mean, because for people who become professional musicians, they really have to start serious training by age 5 or 7 at the latest. And, most kids don't choose to, do rigorous study of classical music at such an early age. I mean, most people start, because their parents want them to, and then especially in Asia, there's stronger emphasis on kind of regimented training, both in practice and lessons. And so that's very central to the way in which these musicians are trained and disciplined, really.
They say the last century was America's century, and this will be China's or Asia's century. Can you foresee a situation when the U.S. and Europe will not be the meccas to which these musicians are drawn, and that you will have orchestras of significant standing in, for instance, China? You already have in Japan, but more so in China.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think so. I mean, and it's interesting. I mean, the introduction of Western music to Asia is not simply kind of a one-way street from West or, say, Europe to Asia. Like, for instance, a lot of Chinese and Korean musicians in the early 20th century, they went to Japan to study, not Europe or the United States, because it was more feasible economically, geographically, and whatnot. And so even today, like in a lot of Japanese orchestras, there are, musicians from other parts of Asia, working there. And so, I can totally see, like, 10, 20 years from now, like, Shanghai Symphony or, Beijing Orchestra, they would be like real players in the world of classical music worldwide.
Mario Shahari. Musicians from a Different Shore is out now on the Temple University Press imprint. Philadelphia's First Person Arts was founded on the idea that the telling of personal stories creates a sense of community through the application of our unique and shared experiences. Its anchor event, now in its sixth year, is an annual festival of memoir and documentary art, presenting talks, recitals, screenings and exhibitions of personal art. Earlier this year, First Person Arts began a series of monthly storytelling competitions that ran from April through October. Tonight, the winners of these monthly contests take the stage in a playoff, or Grand Slam, as part of this year's First Person Arts Festival. Over the summer, WRTI's Susan Lewis attended the third Story Slam to find out what these competitions are all about.
It's a dark and steamy summer night on a small street in Philadelphia. People are streaming up the steps to a second-floor bar at 6th and Bainbridge. Just inside the door stands a man with a handful of forms and a pen. His name is Dan Gashevsky.
When people walk in, they have the option to sign a release form if they want to tell a story on stage or to sign up to judge the stories.
Dan Gashevsky is operations manager for First Person Arts. We're at the third monthly story competition, or SLAM, held at L'Etage, an intimate wine bar with one of two rooms adjacent to the bar slightly elevated, making a perfect stage. The lights are low and the space is packed with people, standing at the bar and seated at small tables. That this event draws such a crowd was a surprise and a relief to First Person Arts president Vicky Solot, who had her concerns as the first Story Slam in April drew near.
Nobody was calling and asking about it, and I thought, it's going to be me and the bartender. We got there, and there was like this crush of people arriving, and by 8:30, when we were about to start, we were turning people away.
The Story Slam grew out of a desire to create more activities during the year that would engage First Person Art's growing community of enthusiasts.
Part of what we decided we were going to really emphasize this year was to create things that were more interactive and more opportunities for people who don't necessarily classify themselves as a writer or a photographer, or they haven't necessarily yet built skills, but they have something to share and an interesting story to tell.
And so the Story Slam was born. Each month at the door is a hat or bucket for names of anyone with a story and the courage to tell it to a room full of strangers. Angel Hogan signed up early, perhaps too early, at the third Story Slam.
About 15 minutes after I put my name in the bucket, the room just filled up and it was packed. So I thought, oh man, maybe this wasn't the best decision because I thought it would be much more low-key, and then it ended up so crowded, so I was very, very, very nervous. And then I thought, well, at the very least, I'll hear what other people are doing.
And then the first name was called.
I'm grabbing one at random. It's either Angel or Angel. Hogan. Is Angel or Angel Hogan here? Where?
Rick Nichols, food columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, was the amiable master of ceremonies for the third Story Slam. In the whimsical spirit of the evening, he cradled a giant styrofoam avocado under his arm, which he hinted he might give away to a particularly inspiring storyteller. Before starting, he read the rules. Each story must be told without notes, be no more than 5 minutes long, be true, and somehow be related to the prescribed theme, which this month was Boiling Point. One by one, names are called, and the stories unfold.
One of the greatest gifts I got when I was about 8 was a rooster, and I carried him around like a baby because he was my pride and joy.
We held the dubious distinction of being the two worst alto saxophone players in our junior high band.
It seems to me most of my Boiling Point stories, and I thought of a lot this week, are all related in some way to that first boyfriend.
Who are all these storytellers vying for the chance to tell their tales? Turns out that there are lots of storytellers among us. Kendra Gaeta, a project planner, was the winner of the second Story Slam.
I'm a talker, first of all. I'm the youngest of 4 kids, so I think that if ever I needed somebody to listen to my idea, I always had to sell it pretty good.
But telling a story like this on stage is not quite the same.
I was really sweating it. When I came in, I was nervous, and I was sure that I was going to go up and leave out some crucial detail and get to the end of it and be like, oh, wait a minute.
Similarly, writer Angel Hogan was used to creating stories.
but not necessarily sharing them in this way. Like, I have done readings before, but it's been like reading from the page. So that was a stretch for me just to get up and tell a story kind of off the cuff.
Many of these true stories are funny, if not a bit outrageous. Kendra Gaeta's winning story the second month was about her absconding with an undergarment from the house of a celebrity. Less risque, but still quirky, Angel Hogan's story was one of growing up on a farm with a very aggressive pet rooster.
It's a funny story, I think, to hear me tell in particular, because I don't necessarily look like the type of person that would have an attack rooster.
It seems natural to go for laughs, and some people may live their lives with an eye for what's funny, like Kendra Gaeta.
I will find myself in a totally weird situation, and I'll be, what can I do to make this a little bit weirder? And then just go from there, because it's just going into your story bank.
Each of us may have a story to tell, but not everyone wants to get up and tell a room full of strangers. First-person president Vicky Solat says that while many of the early stories were shocking or sensational, as time goes on, more people are sharing personal accounts that are just as powerful. Solat was delighted at how supportive the audiences are, as was the case with one storyteller in particular.
This woman was like shaking in her boots. She was so nervous. And she came up and told this very personal, poignant, a little bit bittersweet story. And this audience was completely with her. It had been a little bit about loneliness and so forth, and there was some kind of tie-in with salsa dancing. And there was another guy who had told a story earlier also about salsa dancing, and when she finished her story, he came rushing up on the stage and started dancing with her.
9-4 from judge number one.
After every story ends, the MC calls on each of three judges, whose names are also chosen from a hat.
Judge number two, we got an 8.
Scoring is from 1 to 10, with points for crafting, presentation, adherence to the time limit, and relationship to the theme.
Judge number 3 and 9, really high scores.
After 10 stories have been told, the storyteller with the most points wins. On the one hand, this is serious storytelling. First Person Arts even sponsored a workshop to teach people the craft, how to shape a story with a strong beginning, an arc in the middle, and an ending. Yet, despite the instruction and the competition, winning isn't everything.
I think these personal narratives and the way we see our own lives and the way we fit ourselves into the world around us is really important.
It's so much bigger than what it might seem like initially. I think it fosters community. I think even in that room during the night of the slam, like everybody was there together.
Gathering together to tell stories. We've been doing it since before recorded time. No matter how many iPods or laptops or big screen TVs we own, nothing beats listening to someone tell a good story, at a bedside, around the campfire, or in a neighborhood bar. Oh, and although she didn't win the most points that evening, Angel Hogan went home with MC Rick Nichols' Giant Avocado.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Tonight, the 7 winners of the monthly slams will compete in the Grand Slam. It'll take place at 2111 Sampson Street in Center City, Philadelphia. And that's our show for this week. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore. And I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.